Good evening. This is Adrienne Lobby here with Carolyn Eppel. La Raza Chronicles are taking a break for the rest of the fun drive, and tonight we are taking over their spot to bring you an unusual topic for KPFA, computer and video games. And we have an unusual thank you gift for becoming a member of KPFA during this hour, the opportunity to play a new computer game before it's released. One game industry group claims that 67% of all households play computer or video games. And get this, the average player is not 16. He or she is 34 years old. In fact, 26% of them are 50 or older. So it's time we look at these games a little seriously. And I sought out a couple of men in the business of serious games, and I was looking for some insider information. Here's what they had to say. Peter Brinson is an instructor of interactive media in the School of Cinematic Arts at the University of Southern California. And Kourash Valanijab is the art director of USC's Game Innovation Lab. They're the creators of a new game called The Cat and the Coup, which won the Documentary Award at the 2010 Indiecade. They're offering this game to KPFA's members before its official release date in exchange for your contribution this fun drive. So we'll talk about that later. But first, I want to ask you, Peter Brinson, what is the role of games in our culture? Should we care about them, or are they just casual entertainment?
So what's happened is games have grown up with us. The people who have no memory of video games not being around are in their 30s and 40s. So what's happening is there are more and more games out there that are about the real world and about topics that are a bit more mature, they're in particular nonfiction topics. The answer is it's both. It's still very much entertainment, but it's also a place like books and movies to explore ideas and communicate.
I remember talking to a Native American once and saying, well, I'm so surprised about all these gambling games. You know, it just wasn't PC for those exotic, wonderful Native American spiritual people. And she said, well, what do you think we did in those winter tents, Adrian? And it caused me to step back and say, what's the role of games, period?
Games have been around for thousands of years. They've been around as long as stories. And it's just that they found a really clear home in computers. Computers are a really natural fit for a game. And so they're just looking a lot different, and they've gotten much more obvious and in our face. And the root of games, though, is to play. And we know that everyone on some level likes to play. We know that kids play before they tell stories. So if we compare games to other media that often tell stories, in a way, games have gotten very specific and very visual, but they've been around forever.
So let's talk about the story that's involved in The Cat and the Coup. You take Mossadegh, the first democratically elected prime minister of Iran, and how he was overthrown by the CIA, basically because of oil. Tell us the backstory for The Cat and the Coup. Kourash, would you do that one?
It started in 1951, where Mossadegh, there was a large nationalist movement, and he was the head of it, and they basically argued that Iran, in fact any country, should prosper from their own resources. At the time, the British Petroleum, which was called the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, had this contract with the previous dynasty of Iran, the Qajars, for this oil. And the people of Iran were starving. I mean, they were really suffering, and at the same time, they were witnessing the British, who were working these the oil companies, watching how they were living. And there's actually, at the time, there's signs that said, water fountain signs that said, not for Iranians. So that's really where it started from. It was a popular movement to do that, and obviously the British were pissed off that Iran had broken this contract. But it went past that, and at the time, this was the largest revenue source for the British government, their biggest investment, and so they were about to lose that. So they were playing a little unfair and trying to gain that back. That's where it started from, and it grew from there, and it escalated. At the same time, other things were happening in the region. The British saw this as what it was, which was this domino effect across the region. And it grew from there, Peter?
What I find interesting about this story is the things that feel a bit familiar today, and that's why when we made it, we decided not to make any literal connections with today. We just told the story back in the 50s and 60s and left it at that and let people make connections. So the obvious one is it was about oil. Oh, that sounds familiar. Similarly, what happened from 52 to 53 is the U.S. administrations went from Truman to Eisenhower, and Truman was very clear that he thought the Iranians deserved to be a sovereign nation. They should not be interfered with when the British were upset with them. But things changed with the Eisenhower administration.
This was one of the first successful CIA-engineered coups in the world.
The Secretary of State and the director of the CIA were known as the Dulles brothers, and they were very influential in Eisenhower. And they had just got done working for a law firm that had oil clients who worked with Anglo-Iranian Oil, the British company. This idea of our leaders being connected to industries and having an incredibly obvious conflict of interest, it's not a new idea. I thought it was in this decade with the Iraq War, for example. It was new to me. But looking back, it's just so interesting to see these cycles happening. We're not unearthing some great secret. This is, in fact, knowledge that isn't hard to find in books and the internet, you name it.
We all have a short attention span, partly because of the internet and computers, but you're trying to turn that back and say, hey, let's pay attention to something that you probably maybe have never been heard of, but certainly don't know a lot about.
I use the example of, you know, Mossadegh's story on Wikipedia is right there. My point is that it's not an underground story. It's just the idea of being able to find it.
But it was a secret at the time. It doesn't ask that question, well, what secrets do we not know about now?
Very true, although it's worth noting that at the time, the fear of communism, I feel like, was legitimate, but a lot of things were done in the name of communism, and we can very much find that connection now. Terrorism is not fiction, but a lot of things are done in the name of terrorism. If somebody's cabinet in the White House is all guys who just got done working for some big company, and now they're annoyed that their friends are going to be done wrong by some small country, they find a big problem. A lot of what we know now is based on some CIA documents that were leaked to the New York Times in the year 2000. So we benefited from that tremendously. Those are really good sources because they were written by Donald Wilbur, one of the operatives at the time. He read it in 1954. You can bet that he's not being deceitful. He was writing this report to his superiors with the intention of it never being read by anyone else. And our game definitely utilizes that understanding. So when you play it, it's using all sources that Kharosh found from mainstream sources like the New York Times and Time Magazine. But when you beat it, you see the story played again in a non-interactive way. You don't play it, using sources that are sort of in retrospect. So we can both understand that there was information out there, but we have benefited a lot in hindsight.
This was one of the first successful CIA-engineered coups in the world. So it's historic on that level. Kharosh, I want to go back to you, because I know the story isn't trying to make a big point. It's just trying to help people understand and think about it a little more deeply. But you're an Iranian-American. This has got to have some resonance in your life.
My father's Iranian, but my mother's American, and her family was in the Air Force. Yeah, it definitely resonates in my personal life.
Draw some parallels. Why is what's happening today related to what happened to Mossadegh in the 50s?
Iran is using this event as an excuse to keep America out. They continue to remind the Iranians that the CIA had some effect on the lives of Iranian, the politics of the time. Earlier you had said that this was the first successful CIA operation. That's arguable. From some people's standpoints, the original CIA engineered coup failed. Some people believe it was the actual middle class officers of the army that actually ended up winning. 2 days later, there's another coup, and the CIA takes credit for that. But many Iranians believe that it was actually Iranians that, you know, stood up for the Shah. And then certainly Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Shah, believed that too.
The CIA is known for emboldening rivals of whatever country they're trying to overthrow. But it is true that if you take everyone who takes credit for this coup, there's too many people, from Mossadegh's rivals to the CIA to the British. Definitely the CIA got things in motion, but when you look more closely at the story, it's complicated, and Iran's certainly a complicated country, and definitely Mossadegh had a lot of rivals that in the end sealed the deal.
That was Peter Brinson, one of the creators of the video game The Cat and the Coup, which we are offering you before it is released to the general public tonight as a thank you gift when you join KPFA. We're talking about the background of the game, an incident in Iran in the 1950s. My next question goes to Kharosh Vallanijad, the art director for The Cat and the Coup. I look at it and say, wow, he was going to give the oil back to the people. That sounds really good. Why would any group have enough grassroots support to engineer a coup if they weren't funded by the CIA? I guess the religious people, but why would they be against giving the oil to the country?
So it's about power, right? Ultimately, who takes control of the country after all this settles? And, you know, it wasn't between the time that the oil got nationalized and the coup happened. It was 2 years. And during that 2 years, there's embargoes against Iran. And, you know, so the country was actually suffering even more during that two-year period. And certainly we've seen now how this kind of hardship motivates people, right, to take action. And so maybe that's part of it, too.
Yeah, they in particular had paid just a handful of people compared to the whole population, not many, to riot in the streets and create mayhem. And after a while, a lot of citizens just said, I'm tired of this chaos. What's going to bring some sort of order? In addition to just being able to strengthen and give support to a handful of powerful rivals, money in general goes a long way in a lot of situations.
Yeah, doesn't it? They say you can't throw money at it unless it's a coup de Shah, and then maybe it works. So, Karush, then we had the Shah. The coup put the Shah back in power. And then there was the student-led revolution, which many Americans know as the U.S. hostage crisis, where they put U.S. citizens in the embassy. Were some of those people hoping to go back to a democratically elected situation?
Yes. Yeah, at the time, they renamed the main street in Iran after Mohammad Mossadegh. And it was definitely, at that time in 79, a popular uprising. It was many different groups coming together, really just opposing the absolute dictatorship of the Shah. But as you probably heard in the news recently, you know, they're worried now about all the things that are going on in the Middle East and that they don't want these democratic movements to be hijacked, right? And so the example they use is the 79 revolution in Iran. A lot of people feel that once the Shah was pushed out, that the Ayatollahs hijacked this movement and then claimed credit for it.
Right, right. This is Adrienne Lobby. You're listening to KPFA 94.1 FM. I've been talking to Karush Vallanijad and Peter Brinson, the creators and developers of a new computer game called The Cat and the Coup. We'll be offering it as a thank you gift for your membership later on in the show. You two are digital guys, and obviously the world has changed a lot. Computer revolution has come since the 50s. What might have Mossadegh done if he had access to computer games or cell phones?
He would, at minimum, be able to communicate directly with the people. Of course, they had radio, so it could go one way. Whomever controlled that radio had some power. I certainly think he would have been for the idea of people making their own democracy, so to speak. But I often think that these technologies make things more convenient, but in the end, the people in Egypt that really got their act together, I feel like they still would have done it without Twitter. The Green Revolution 2 years ago and the folks in Egypt, they saved Twitter, not the other way around. Things have gotten more convenient and straightforward, but it's still up to the people.
When I played the game, there was a sense that Mossadegh was very isolated in his room with his cat, especially after the riots happened. So maybe a little communication might have eased his isolation.
It's very intentional that it's sort of a quiet game that Mossadegh is alone, and it's just, what do you do in this situation, you as the cat? That's also supposed to be a metaphor for what it's like to be a leader. People say, well, why did you use a cat as his companion, as the player? And that's because when you make a short game in particular, you want to start and allow people to have some preconceptions that are going to work for them. And when someone sees a cat, they think, I don't actually know who this character represents right away, and I don't know if they're my friend or not my friend. What is their exact agenda? And so that works really well with thinking about Mossadegh's relationship with various people, and in particular to the United States. This seems foreign to me, but in 52, he very clearly said, hey, you guys used to be a colony of England, and I'm like you. The United States is different. He didn't think there was a clear connection between England and the United States in terms of foreign policy agendas. And I think we were really at a crossroads there, the kind of country we wanted to be and the direction we wanted to take. Nowadays, I think of United States and England being one and the same when it comes to business and empire.
You're saying Mossadegh at some point thought that maybe the U.S. citizens looking at their own revolution would say, oh, this is good, and come down on his side.
Absolutely. And it's kind of too bad it didn't turn out that way. And I think there were a lot of Americans who could have. I mean, that was basically Truman's attitude, as he said, I don't plan on overthrowing this guy. This is not a legitimate national crisis. This is a crisis of money. And a lot of people have asked, why didn't you make the game a what-if game? That is, what if you had made some choices and seen how things could have been different? So if you play the game one way or another way, you could see how things would be different today. But we don't have to do that. We let people imagine that themselves. As some of your listeners trying to imagine how things would be different today if this hadn't happened is just as valid as if we had imagined it and put it in the game.
Well, let's talk about the game, because the images of the game, I felt like I was entering another world. I've seen that in other games, of course, but this is a particularly beautiful world. And Karush, I think you did the game design, the story, and the script. So tell us about what you were thinking when you put it together.
Peter and I talked a lot about what would the right sort of look for this game be, what would be appropriate. So I had a sense of what he was going for, but then we looked at the art that came out of the region, right? And so Persian miniatures seemed like a natural fit. I mean, looking back now, it just seems like the obvious choice. But we also looked at some of the other Persian styles of art. The wall carvings at Persepolis was another example. Persian miniatures are essentially illustrated books where the image supports the text. And oftentimes, an image has to tell an entire story, right? So one character, one figure can actually appear many times on the page. So for those reasons, it just was a perfect fit. The game is basically a huge collage of hundreds of Persian miniatures brought together.
On one level, this game genre is considered a platformer in that you are looking at it from a horizontal view. It's like Super Mario Brothers, just in this perspective of looking straight on at the character, and it's fairly 2D world, and the character's jumping around, right, the cat. But the way he used Persian miniatures, the space is a little bit subjective, or often subjective. So sometimes a space will both look like a floor and a wall by embracing what happened a lot of time in Persian miniatures. And when you see it move, it's kind of a nice question, well, am I going to land there, or is that the wall in front of me? So that's just a nice little layer of subjectivity that works well with the overall project of trying to discover and trying to ask yourself, what is this story about and who's in charge and what is the truth here?
Once we had decided to go with that look, finding Persian miniatures turned out to be quite a challenge. In our own library system at USC, I was able to find, I think it was 14 books, and very few of those actually had color images in them. And if they did, they tended to be small. And so we reached out, and we were very lucky to have here in Los Angeles, at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. The Art of the Middle East section of that has a huge collection, and the curator, Linda Komaroff, is very generous to give us access not only to the library at LACMA, but also her personal library. We're certainly indebted to her and to her assistant, Sabrina Lovett, for giving us this rare opportunity to look at and scan these large, oversized, rare books, and that really made a huge difference in the look of the game. It's very rare that anyone's going to let you actually touch or scan an original Persian miniature. But, you know, Linda Komaroff goes back and forth to Iran. She buys things all the time. And in her collection, she had this beautiful book from the Tehran Art Museum, which I got a lot of great images from.
The artwork gave me a sense of timelessness. As Mossadegh falls from the frame of one picture into the other, I get a moment to contemplate what's going on behind the scenes and in current events. Basically, the game is a series of puzzles.
It's a series of puzzles, and just like you said, in between, some of the narrative unfolds as you're either following or Mossadegh's following you from one space to another.
Talk about the music.
Very early on, when it first started in 2007, there's a cat, there's Mossadegh. The only other things that really made it to the end were this one piece by Eric Satie called Nocien Number 1. And more recently, we got our colleague Vince Diamante to perform it and make it sound a little wobbly and a little dissonant and a little more macabre, which was, I just have to say, it's so much fun for me to do stuff like that. And then in the closing is music by Nine Inch Nails. There's an album called Ghosts that came out in 2008, a 36-song album that is described as music for daydreams. I just want to say quickly that the first 9 songs are free and the rest altogether are $5, so it's not a big leap to try to check it out. But in particular, the music's released under Creative Commons, which in this case means that you're allowed to use it in any piece you want. He was saying pretty overtly, put it in your movies, put it in your videos, but it means we put it in our game, and as long as we don't make money off the game, it's completely legal, which is really exciting. And I think there's been a lot of fans of Nine Inch Nails who've spent decades wishing they could legally put his music into their work.
It's beautiful, haunting music. And what's the effect of something like Creative Commons been on video games and nonprofit developers especially?
It definitely helps. It's sort of an official way of acknowledging something that was already happening. People are already sampling. People are already going to take something and repurpose it. And maybe when we release our game in June, people will do that on some level. And in terms of video games, that has been happening from the very beginning. And developers know that. So even in the early 90s, when games like Doom would come out, the developers would package it with the editing tools that they themselves had used to make it. Now this is completely normal. Every other game that comes out for the PC, one little part of it includes this editor where you can change the level and make your own levels. This is very common. For years now, developers embrace it and they expect it, and a lot of people get jobs by taking an existing game and changing it around and saying, hey, here's the level I made for your game. And that's not Creative Commons discreetly, but it is an attitude of, I'm going to put something out there and I'm going to see what you guys do with it. And that is completely natural for a game, because a game, you're supposed to play with it, either the way you were asked to play with it or to play with it in a more
underlying technical way.
Yes, and so that spirit is there. And of course, you do that with music, and that is not typically embraced. That's usually very much frowned upon by the music industry, take something and manipulate. But I just want to say again, part of the reason we were able to use the Nine Inch Nails music is, he's one example of a musician who does now release his music of individual tracks. You can download them and then remix it yourself and then upload it back to his site. And there's like contests to see who has the best remix. And they say nothing about how the music is now free, essentially.
They're basically trying to embrace the creativity and hope that the money part will happen.
Yes, so we're definitely in a transition. We made this project for Americans, but I also have this hope that Iranians will download it and give their opinion on the internet about it. And if you think of art as a form of communication, then I would love it if somebody in Iran responded with another piece of some sort of video game. Would be great. You know, like I said, this story is not secret. It's just we're continuing the conversation. It's clear at this point our governments, the United States and Iran, are just not going to get along. And I hope that the people, like artists, can have a back and forth with their projects to communicate and see if we can outdo our governments.
What do you think, Karush? Do you have any optimism on that level?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very optimistic about that. Last year, the Iranian government, they invited 2,000 expats back to Iran. And I got invited, and I'm really sorry I didn't take up that opportunity. And I'm hoping that they do it again this year, because I'd love to go back and show this game and see how people on the ground, not the politicians, how they react to it. And it'd be very funny if someone modded the game, gave their own meaning to it.
It would be such a compliment if somebody modded it and they put the time and effort in to respond to our project.
You use the word mod it, which I imagine means modify it?
Yeah, modification.
Killscreen is a magazine for gamers. It's fairly new on the market. Where does it fit? What is it going to do to the world of gamers if it's successful?
Everyone I know thinks it's awesome. They found a really nice balance between among various ideas. So one is it's sort of modern in that it's about video games, and it's not for kids. It's definitely aimed towards adults in terms of its intellectual level, but it's also very fun. And its contributors, like, you can go on their website and see that you can write an article and send to them and see if they're interested and see if they want to publish it. So they you know, it's probably very competitive, I'm guessing, but you know, it's drawing from the pool of real people out there. But also, it is a magazine. It looks a little bit like a little book. I mean, it has very few ads, and it's thick and it's real. In other words, it's an old technology. It's something you can read in bed when you're going to sleep. And so I think they found a really nice balance. And it's basically, for me, it's a celebration of various serious and not serious things about games. I think about, like, this one called Sucker Punch is this interview with various game designers about times they've actually been beaten up, and which is,
I mean, physically beaten up.
Yeah, physically beaten up. And this is placed in the contrast with that a lot of game designers, what they do for a living is make games about getting beaten up or beating people up. So it's actually really, this article was alarming. There's just a handful of people in it. But to hear, like, how horrible it is to get beaten up. Another one, my favorite one probably, is this one called Character Building, where this guy is, this real guy, he talks about how he's an anorexic. And He wasn't able in his life to sort of admit it to himself or perceive it in his own life and grapple with it personally and consciously. But he was playing one of the Grand Theft Auto games, and in Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, you can eat or exercise, and his character actually got very skinny because in the game he was exercising him and not feeding him, and his character got incredibly thin. The weight in the game is not the focus of the game, but it's a component. And through that, he was able to understand his own anorexia by looking at his game character he spent so much time with. And there's other much more lighter articles, like Boxed Out is one where it kind of is a celebration or has nostalgia for game box covers. It used to be very important back when games had terrible graphics or no graphics at all. The actual cover was often embellished and beautiful and not unlike a book. The only visual cue you could give your audience, so it was like a look back on how that was kind of a nostalgia, having some nostalgia for that time. And there's all kinds of stuff like that.
I was really impressed by the very philosophical, social kind of themes. The current one is called Intimacy. And the original one, Video Games Are No Fun, which I think was a theme about the ways that video games are serious.
They do a good job of coming up with good themes, and when you read, you know, the whole collection, I don't know if there's like, I don't know, roughly 10 or 12 articles in each edition, but you see how some are very directly related and others are kind of work in the periphery of the idea, but definitely they opened up with the first issue just confronting that idea that supposedly games are always supposed to be fun, and the articles don't really contradict that, but they just open up and expand on that. And it's not a small point that I think what is modern about Killscreen is it understands that its audience and its authors are basically the same people, and by having contributors, and you know, for something like YouTube, that's a familiar perspective. But in this case, of course, Killscreen curates and takes the best stuff. And there's only been 3 issues so far. I imagine number 4 is coming out soon. And I've just thoroughly enjoyed, some of the writing is just so beautiful and wonderful. And I think really represents a lot of these folks who've grown up with games and are now ready to take them into their adult lives. And whatever that happens to mean, whether they make games about something serious or not, or they're just looking back on what it means to them.